You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards Tiekert. One of the enduring genres of pop academic writing is the story of where we came from, how humanity went from purportedly scattered groups of hunter-gatherers to increasingly complex agricultural societies, and what it tells us about the enduring qualities of human nature and our political arrangements in the present. Now, this often presents as a whimsical journey into prehistory, but it is almost always doing work as myth. It is telling us a story about who we are, and usually conveying some kind of moral or political lesson about our institutions and political arrangements. And it's just one problem. A lot of the prehistory that our society has used to draw political lessons doesn't really hold up to the actual evidence. That drove our next guest to work with the late anthropologist David Graeber on the mother of all fact checks. David Wengrow is professor of comparative archaeology at the University College London, and his sprawling new book with Graeber is The Dawn of Everything, A New History of Humanity. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Let's start with the capsule summary. You subtitled this A New History of Humanity. What would you say the old history is?
The old history, we feel, is not really a history, actually. I think your description of a myth is closer to reality, which is, of course, to be expected. I mean, all societies have their myths, and European-related societies are no exception to that. But the myth about our own species' past that we've been telling ourselves for many generations now is now so far removed from the evidence that's accumulated. In my field, I'm an archaeologist, and in my late co-author's field of anthropology and in related fields of historical study, that it's becoming not only something of an embarrassment in terms of its kind of intellectual foundations, but it's also potentially a dangerous myth insofar as people draw conclusions about the possibilities of human social life, which are fairly grim. To try and explain what I mean, you could actually contrast our familiar story of human history, the conventional wisdom, with other myths from all around the world, Native American myths, myths from ancient Greece, which often begin with creativity. So you begin with these kind of mythical superhuman beings who may be half one species, half another, sort of godlike heroes who create everything. And there's this great sort of big bang of creation. And then in these other non-European myths, very often, normal, ordinary mortals are kind of fated to be pale reflections of that original age of creation. Our myth, the myth of let's say, Western societies broadly, is strangely the opposite. It tells a story about how our species originated in small bands of hunter-gatherers who basically have nothing in the way of technology or material goods. But because of their rudimentary life, because of their simplicity, what they can have is equality and freedom. And then, or this is how the myth goes, with each kind of step out of Eden, if you like, because we're talking about some imaginary Garden of Eden-like setting for the origins of our species, with each step out of that into a world of technological sophistication and cultural advancement, we lose some of those freedoms and some of that equality. So first comes agriculture, and from that is supposed to come private property and territoriality. Populations grow, cities come about, and with cities one needs governors and kings and warriors and priests. And before you know it, you've got a kind of ambivalent tale, a fable about civilization, which says that in order to have all the benefits and the good things about civilization, the things we value, like advanced medicine, philosophy, art, you also have to sacrifice some of those primordial freedoms. Now, almost nothing about the story I've just told is true. Almost no element of it actually stands up to scrutiny in the light of modern scientific evidence. But it's still the prevailing story that I think most people have in their heads, and that you'll find in most best-selling books about the history of humanity and world history. So what we're trying to do in The Dawn of Everything is bring readers up to speed with what's happened in our fields, and also to kind of unpick the origins of that other story, that myth.
Okay, let's start by kind of setting the table with the political stakes. Like, myths exist to do work. So what is the story about our lost Edenic existence as hunter-gatherers do for the European society that created it?
Well, the 20th century anthropologist Claude Lévi-Strauss had a famous kind of analysis of how myths actually work in practice. And he said what they really do is resolve paradoxes, or seem to resolve paradoxes that actually can't, in the last resort, be resolved. In this case, we have a myth which probably has been most elegantly expressed by the Swiss-French philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau in the 18th century, when he said, "Man is born free, but everywhere we find him in chains." So there's a classic paradox, there's an opposition. We're born free, but look around, we're all in some way confined to institutions and forms of domination. We don't feel as free as we once were. And to resolve that paradox, I think, as Lévi-Strauss puts it, there always has to be some kind of mediator in the story. In many myths, it's some kind of trickster figure who's got one foot in one half of the paradox and one foot in the other. In our myth, our familiar story of civilization, I think the role of the trickster, the mediator, is probably the idea of technology or technological progress, because, on the one hand, progress is meant to be a good thing, like being free is meant to be a good thing. And yet, every time we progress, we also slip back a bit further into our chains, and the chains get tighter. So it does a kind of mythical work on the person hearing it and internalizing that story, which is not really that dissimilar to the kind of stories you grow up with. If you're brought up on biblical tales about how it all begins in Genesis with the state of innocence, and then there's a transgression, and we eat from the tree of knowledge, we get wise, but at the same time we become burdened with all of these extra chores and sort of all the pains and sufferings of human life. So there are biblical echoes to this story as well. And I think the overriding message is something along the lines of don't fool around, don't have too much fun, don't experiment, don't mess with the status quo, because you see where it leads. It's always going to come back and bite you. So it's almost a kind of parable of history, which is, you could call it sort of anti-play, anti-experimentation. Stay in one place. The road we're on is kind of the only one available. And it underpins studies which in other respects are very modern and rigorous on a whole range of topics. I've seen books about how the development of human value systems and ethics. I've seen books about how we can find a sustainable relationship with the Earth system, books about, obviously, inequality and political order, all of which are very good, but underpinning them are just these very, very basic assumptions about the direction of travel, which say that once upon a time we lived in small, egalitarian, simple societies, and with complexity and with scale, inevitably comes a loss of those original freedoms.
Very interesting for them to locate that in the past, because in their present, European society was in repeated contact with human societies in Africa, in the Americas, in other parts of the world that were organized very differently. It was their present.
This is so interesting. I read, it's a problem at the moment, to be honest, it's a nice problem to have, because People are reading The Dawn of Everything, and it's wonderful to see that people are responding by actually writing their own essays, if you like, and self-publishing often on their blogs on various different platforms. And I don't have time, unfortunately, to digest them all at the moment, but I definitely will, because many of them are incredibly interesting. And I started reading one the other day by a philosopher. I'm afraid I've forgotten the name. But he turns around that famous phrase that comes from, I think it's from L.P. Hartley's novel, The Go-Between. Do you know that one? It was one of my favorites as a kid. We had to read it at school. The past is a foreign country. They do things differently there. That's where the phrase comes from, I think. And in his review of the book, his reflections on the book, he says, well, the past isn't just a foreign country. He says, the past is an Indian reservation. And I thought, wow, that's okay. He's taken something from the book there and condensed it into really one line, which I think touches on something very true, which is that the way Europeans came to characterize non-European societies, which they were colonizing, but also mixing and blending with in various complicated ways, works in parallel with our changing understanding of our own past and what our distant ancestors were like. And something that really struck me and David Graeber as we got further into this project is how dehumanizing a lot of that writing is. You know, the way we write about the early phases of human existence is slightly bizarre. I mean, you'd never think these were people with brains and bodies basically the same as ours, people making conscious decisions about the kind of societies they want to live in, people trying out different forms of economy, different political systems. Instead, we get this kind of pastiche of humanity, which is meant to stand in for, well, most of human history and prehistory. And it struck us that there's something fundamentally odd about that, which also resonates with the way that indigenous societies have been stereotyped and simplified and turned into these kind of fantasy sort of, you know, totalities that don't really resemble what we like to think of as our own societies in any respect, either exoticized or put down or racialized. So I was really struck by that statement and by that relationship between, if you like, you know, how contemporary societies are characterized and how our own past is characterized as well.
So if the old mythologized narrative is humanity spends tens of thousands of years as scattered hunter-gatherer tribes, agriculture emerges, agricultural production creates surpluses, surpluses support soldiers, a political class, an administrative bureaucracy, ever more sophisticated and urbanized societies, and they inevitably squeeze out the pastoralists and the hunter-gatherers near them. What is the evidence to contradict that Pat narrative?
Well, if we pick up just one strand of it, the idea of agriculture giving rise to the first notions of private property, which implies that before agriculture, people didn't have that sense of ownership or attachment to the land or other possessions. Now, that idea has a very, very specific history. In the 18th century, it's what was referred to as the agricultural argument, and you'll find it in the writings of people like John Locke and his treatise on government. And it's an argument that was explicitly used to justify the appropriation of indigenous lands, not just in the Americas, but all over the world, was the idea that these people didn't own the land, that they were hunters and gatherers, even when they weren't, because very often actually they were either farming societies part-time farming societies or societies that manage their landscapes in other ways, and certainly had notions of property, even if they were different from European ones. But this was the pretext, is that these are not really what I think Locke referred to as improving landlords. It's actually the European idea of property and land ownership here is quite mystical. It's all about mixing your labor with the soil. And if you're not doing agriculture in the way that we tend to think of it, somehow you're just a tenant, you know, you're not really owning the land. And this was used explicitly as a pretext for the murder, genocide of many, many communities and the appropriation of lands. And, you know, you'd have thought today that that kind of assumption would be viewed very critically. But in fact, on at least two fronts, it's kind of still with us. It's still with us in the kind of disputes that indigenous peoples are still involved with in courts of law, trying to assert their own title to land in terms that will be somehow recognized and compatible with European or European-derived systems of law. And it's still there in history, in scientific papers that associate the origins of property with the origins of agriculture, which are still being written today. And there's really no reason to think that way, because we know a lot about, first of all, agricultural societies that didn't have systems of private property, like the ones that I've described. There are many, many examples of agricultural societies that organize themselves in more egalitarian ways. And on the other side, we also know that there are many societies that didn't practice agriculture, but nevertheless had very clearly formulated ideas about property and ownership. So to come back to your question, you know, this is one of the ways in which although archaeology scientifically now is very sophisticated, and we're constantly finding out more about the wheres and the whens of history, when it comes to the big kind of how and why questions, the big questions of social evolution, we still seem to be stuck with some very, very outdated concepts. So what we try to do in the book is to brush away some of those cobwebs of basically Victorian theorizing, or even earlier theorizing about the evolution of human customs and institutions, and just look at the evidence that's before us now. And what you see is really something spectacularly different to the traditional story. For example, we know now that before the invention of agriculture, human societies were incredibly diverse. Some of them resemble the kind of egalitarian bands that have always been imagined, but others really don't. You know, in North America, we have examples. I guess the most spectacular is in Louisiana, the site of Poverty Point, which is a huge amphitheater, a kind of a series of massive earthworks on the scale of a city built by non-farming people 3,500 years ago or so, where you must have had thousands of hunter-gatherers coming together for reasons we don't quite understand. But clearly, these are not small egalitarian groups. You know, there's something else going on there. If you go to the other end of the Pacific and look at the pre-rice farming cultures of Japan, the hunter-gatherer Jomon civilization, there you've got everything from towns with big central storage facilities to aristocratic-looking burials. It's a whole kind of world of social experimentation before the coming of agriculture, which means we really have to just do away with these simplistic stage-like narratives that basically deny all of that, and also at the same time understand their roots and the often explicitly colonial contexts that they come out of, what they were used for in terms of justifying the contemporary displacement of non-European peoples.
In the dominant narrative, that displacement is an inevitability, but at some point it was also a choice, one that had to be rationalized.
Exactly. And when you strip away the inevitables, the sort of imponderable forces of history that supposedly set us on the course to where we are now, that's exactly what you're left with, is people making choices. And one of the things we try to show in the book is that as far back as you can take things, to the best of our knowledge, in terms of being able to actually reconstruct the form of human societies, that's exactly what we see, is people making choices, moral, ethical choices all the way along. Sometimes they're choices we might empathize with, sometimes they're choices that repel and disgust us. But nevertheless, there was something to be discussed, as opposed to people just mindlessly adapting to their environments or responding to forces beyond their control, or following some evolutionary pattern that we feel we can discern, but that they were completely ignorant of.
One of the more interesting things you go through in the archaeological record is evidence of cities that did not have political hierarchies.
Mm-hmm. That's right. This is a major revelation of, I guess, really the last 20 or 30 years. I mean, even when I was just beginning in archaeology as a student, early 1990s, you would still pick up a book on the origin of cities, and it was basically a book about the origins of the state. So the origins of the cities and the origins of the state was more or less assumed to be the same thing, regardless of whether you're looking at Mesoamerica or East Asia or the Middle East or Africa, wherever it may be. This was assumed to be the evolutionary pattern. And for a long time, it looked as if that was the case. You know, you look at ancient Egypt or early Mesopotamia, or the early cities of the Valley of Mexico, and that's what you see, all the great pyramid temples and human sacrifice and the appearance of central bureaucracy. That's the overwhelming picture that I think archaeologists and anthropologists subscribe to until around that time. But more recently, information has been coming in from various different quarters of the world, sometimes from the same regions where the state of knowledge has just improved over time, which really throws all this into question. We talk about the Indus Valley civilization of South Asia, which has always been a bit paradoxical in this respect. It's actually been known about for more than a century. The excavations at sites like Mohenjo-Daro and Harappa in Pakistan. Those are cities. They go back over 4,000 years. They are planned cities with very sophisticated hygiene and drainage facilities, but they don't present evidence for ruling classes. There is very little in the way of writing. There is a script, the Indus Valley, the so-called Indus script. It's never really been truly deciphered, but it doesn't seem to be part of any kind of centralized government organization. There are no royal burials. There's no imagery associated with kingship or conquest. There's no great monuments, no palaces. In fact, it's really very hard to understand what the political system of these early cities was. Some archaeologists have claimed recently that they are basically egalitarian cities of some sort. That's just one example, but there are others north of the Black Sea in Ukraine and Moldova. You have even more ancient settlements which housed tens of thousands of people, which show absolutely no signs of social stratification or rank. They're just these enormous kind of rings of similarly sized houses. They look like tree rings when you look at an aerial image of one of these sites. And they're organized in circles. Each house is slightly different, and they have a very rich and vibrant material culture. Beautifully painted ceramics, lots of figurines of images of females, quite often very prominent, but no obvious signs of wealth differentiation, no evidence of writing or administration, and certainly no indication that there's some kind of elite ruling class. And these settlements go on for hundreds and hundreds of years. And we have other cases from Central America, China, where cities that begin in a kind of centralized hierarchical fashion then go into reverse, and people actually redesign urban societies on more egalitarian principles. So what I'm trying to give you a picture of is just the range of different possibilities that we're now aware of. In other words, cities right from the beginning seem to have been sites of experimentation, people trying out different forms of life, making choices.
And also not isolated from one another. I think like one of the conceits of academic study is you try to draw a firm boundary around the object of study. So you decide that one society stops at a given point where another one starts. But everyone's talking to each other, trading with each other, learning from each other. Like there are no isolated people.
Right. And it's interesting how different that process looks. So my fieldwork mostly is in the Middle East, most recently in northern Iraq, in Iraqi Kurdistan. And if you work, as I have, on sites that date back to that period of the initial emergence of the world's first cities, what you find in the Middle East or South Asia, those Indus Valley sites, is exactly what you just said. These are not kind of sealed communities. They form these great regional systems where there's trade and interaction over really impressive areas, sometimes over water, sometimes caravan trade. But they're littered with the evidence of this, usually in the form of pottery and ceramic containers, these great commercial civilizations. And it's interesting when you compare that to North America. You find something interestingly different. You've still got the great regional systems. So if we go back about 600 years or slightly more in the Mississippi Basin, you've got the ancient city known as Cahokia, which forms the epicenter of one of these vast regional systems, reaching up almost as far as the Great Lakes and down to the Gulf Coast. But it's a very different kind of regional system to what you find in ancient Eurasia. The Eurasian ones fit a sort of familiar picture where expansion from an urban center takes the form of trade and commerce. So you find all of these kind of, you know, the packaging for all these commodities that are being sent out of cities, and there are metals and other goods flowing back in from the sort of highland peripheries or the desert peripheries around their edges. So it's a fairly familiar idea of trade and commerce. With Cahokia, it's really intriguing because when people try to apply those kind of models to actually various parts of the Americas, they don't really work. You can see that there's a center like Cahokia, or the much earlier center of Poverty Point. You can see that people are coming into the center. You can see that they're bringing stuff with them, you know, the things that survive in the archaeological record. But you can't see what's going out. They don't seem to be commercial empires of the kind that we've come to expect in the history of Eurasia. To our minds, this was really intriguing, because the more we sort of read into it, the more we came to the conclusion that the kind of value systems that underpinned those regional systems and the forms of domination that underpinned them were just fundamentally different. I'll give you an example. There was actually a study recently where a group of archaeologists tried to compare the history of inequality in very deep time between the Americas and Eurasia. And they did it by measuring certain things. So they would measure over thousands of years archaeological evidence for things like the size of people's houses or the amount of wealth put into graves and burials and funerals and that sort of thing. And I'm oversimplifying, but basically they come to the conclusion that generally rates of inequality were lower in the Americas than in ancient Eurasia. Now, that all makes one very large assumption. Right? It assumes that the basis of inequality is, in fact, material wealth. But if you look at the more recent history of indigenous societies in various parts of the Americas, including sources that date to the earliest colonial encounters with Europeans, it's clear that, for example, among some Iroquoian-speaking and Algonquin-speaking groups, there was no such concept. In fact, they were quite mystified by the way that Europeans were able to turn wealth into power over each other. And of course, it's a mystery that we ourselves have been trying to unpick since the days of Karl Marx. You know, how does it really work? Why is it that, you know, simply having more stuff than somebody else gives people these incredible privileges? And actually, many indigenous systems of value were based on different principles, where it was more about intangible knowledge and what anthropologists have referred to as ownership of sacred things, which are almost like our idea of patents and copyrights. So you wouldn't necessarily own the land, but you would own access to sacred knowledge by virtue of your clan membership or your family ties, which would entitle you to use the land and its resources. It's a more complex relationship in a way, and it hinges on ownership of these intangibles, these rather esoteric forms of knowledge, which were traded and exchanged, almost like commodities. So at the center of the system is actually something intangible. And if you then look at these great regional systems, like the ones emanating from Poverty Point and Cahokia, what you begin to see is that actually a lot of their authority, a lot of their ability to influence these wider regions and populations seems to have been based more on the control of knowledge, particularly these kind of esoteric forms of knowledge, often in the form of calendrical rituals, often linked to the agricultural cycle. So yes, you do have always this large scale of interaction between societies, but the form of the interaction and what underpins it can be very different.
And the repository of value can be something completely different from material wealth or control over property.
Exactly.
So if I were to recap, I would say the old history is that the human past is hunter-gatherer societies, which are inevitably replaced by more sophisticated hierarchical ones, which happen to be the Europeans who are plundering the rest of the world and writing pseudo-academic tracts justifying the arrangements they are imposing. What you're describing is kind of a crazy quilt of experimentation with different social arrangements happening around the world. And I think that the missing element that we've done is that it's not entirely displaced by European society. Ideas and arrangements move both ways.
That's right. And actually, one of the things we go into at the start of the book is how the origins of that mythical idea of human history that we started our conversation with actually lie precisely there. It all really hinges around a series of encounters between mainly French colonists and indigenous societies precisely in that region around Montreal up to the Great Lakes, which resulted, I mean, this was around the time of what traditionally we call the Age of Enlightenment, when European philosophers become excited and enamored about ideas of social freedom, along with a whole bunch of other ideas about material gain and wealth and money and so on. But it's the first time in that colonial encounter that Europeans actually witness entire societies based on principles of social freedom, which at that point were really completely alien to European societies. So we're talking here about the 17th century, the early 18th century. And we have accounts, records by Jesuit missionaries, but also by travelers, soldiers, agents of the colonial government, of actual encounters, conversations that took place between leading figures in indigenous societies and Europeans, some of which became incredibly popular in Europe itself. The most important one, by general consent, was published in 1701. The author was a minor French nobleman by the name of the Baron La Hontan, and it's his dialogues with what he calls a wise savage by the name of Adario. And this became a kind of, became a bestseller and was widely imitated in Europe. And in it, La Hontan himself has this kind of back and forth with Adario on all of the big topics that would later become central preoccupations of Enlightenment philosophy. So there's discussion about institutions of marriage, there's discussions about revealed religion and the nature of God and Christianity, and there are also discussions about freedom and equality. And La Hontan, in the debates that he presents, generally loses the argument to Adario. He gets constantly outwitted in his own text. And it's generally assumed that this is all basically a fabrication, that Adario is a figment of La Hontan's imagination, kind of sock puppet that he's using to express his own dissatisfactions with European civilization. So Adario will point out the kind of obsession with money, the way that Europeans are competing with each other all the time, but also obeying orders and forming ranks all of the time. And that's been the general consensus until recently. Except among scholars, including some scholars who are themselves of indigenous descent, who've looked again at these texts and compared them to accounts in the Jesuit Relations, for example. And it's actually very clear that Adario is based on a particular individual who went by many names in the literature. He's most often referred to as Kandiyarong, who was famous around that time, the end of the 17th century, both as a leading figure of the Huron-Wendat nation, but also as an incredible thinker and orator who we know from various sources did precisely that. He would go to the as the honored guest of the then governor general of that region of the French colonies, what they called New France, and have these debates, some of which were recorded. And the popularity of these critiques, what we call in the book the indigenous critique of European civilization, was extraordinary in Europe at that time. And remember, we're just a few decades prior to the French Revolution. What we describe in the book is how among more conservative European philosophers of the time, a kind of counter-response developed to this critique. And it's most clearly expressed in the writings of the economist Turgot, the French economist and physiocrat, where he basically argues that social freedoms are possible and desirable, but they're only available to you if you live in a state of technological backwardness. So he essentially takes the kind of sentiments expressed by Kandiyarong and other indigenous critics and puts them at the bottom rung of an evolutionary ladder, which he more or less comes up with. It's really the first time that we find this whole idea of human history as a succession of technological stages or modes of production, where suddenly it becomes very important to distinguish between hunter-gatherers, agriculturalists, and commercial urban industrial civilization. This is where it begins. And it begins as a way of neutralizing what would otherwise be a very forceful and subversive critique of hierarchy and social inequality. So characters, figures, historical figures like Kandiyarong get sort of relegated to the bottom of this evolutionary sequence, so that whatever they say, you know, it may be of interest in allowing us to reconstruct distant eras of our own past, but it can no longer form the basis of a critique of how we actually live today in large technologically sophisticated societies. And I mean, it struck me recently with the climate summit that we're almost replaying these kind of debates today if you look at the alternatives out there in terms of forming sustainable relationships with fragile environments, it's clear that in many cases, indigenous societies are way ahead of us in their thinking about these things, and you know, they've been doing it for generations, and we're playing catch up again. But in that way, we see both the origins of the familiar kind of story of human history, but also the beginnings of that kind of sense of being stuck in one particular trajectory of development.
David Wengrow, but before we let you go, I want to talk a little bit about the book as a project. Your co-author, David Graeber, would come through our radio station pretty much every time he released a book. And it always seemed impossible to disentangle his academic work from his activism and political commitments. His book on debt came out, you know, the same year that he was like sitting in grindingly long consensus-based general assemblies in Zuccotti Park during Occupy Wall Street. When you two started putting this massive book together, did you talk about it as a political project or purely an academic one?
No, it was never a political project in that sense. I have to admit, I've been a little bit baffled by some of the reviews of the book, which, you know, immediately slap a label on it. So this is an anarchist history. I mean, if we wanted to do that, we could have written a really short book, like a pamphlet or a manifesto. You don't need a 700-word tome with 50 pages of bibliographical references in order to make a political statement. And I think anyone who reads the book can see that that's not what we're doing. And actually, we don't explicitly link it really to any sort of burning political issue of the moment. But of course, that's not to say that it doesn't have a political message in exactly the same way that other kinds of histories, the kinds that we're criticizing, have an explicitly political message. I mean, the kind of books that we take to task in chapter one for their factual inaccuracies, recent books by Steven Pinker, Francis Fukuyama, among others, will state explicitly that the upshot, you know, the overriding message of their big histories is a very political one, which is that, you know, if you want to have any sort of real structural change in society, you better forget it. You know, don't even bother getting out of bed, because there are forces of social evolution at work which basically make that impossible, or at least confine it to fairly minor tinkering with the system we've got. That's a strong political message. Our book, in many ways, tries to show that it's a message which isn't really founded on much in terms of either empirical evidence or psychology, and just tries to open up other ways of thinking about human capacities that have been closed off by these rather mythological tales of human history. So I think, you know, there is a strong, very logical tie-in to David's activism, but it's not political in the sense that I think your question implied. I mean, David predominantly, I think, was associated and very active and worked very hard in social movements like Occupy, like the Global Justice Movement, which precisely were about asking about other possibilities. You know, is the cultural system we have inevitable? Is it the only and the best way that we can actually arrange ourselves as human societies? And if you're invested in those kinds of questions, it's a very logical step to then look scientifically at all of the different ways that humans actually have organized themselves. But as I've tried to explain, when other people have gone to do that, the result has been kind of the opposite. It's this sort of teleological story about how what we have now was inevitable, which, as we try to show in the book, really doesn't reflect the state of knowledge that we have today. And actually, there are many more alternatives that have already been tried. They're already part of the fabric of our species history, if we can just throw off some of these blinkers and see what's now before our eyes in the historical record.
Well, David Wengrow, I think that's a really good note to end on. I want to thank you so much for being so generous with your time with us and so generous with your work in this incredible book.
Thank you so much for having me.
David Wengrow is Professor of Comparative Archaeology at University College London. His latest book was co-authored with the late David Graeber. It's entitled The Dawn of Everything, A New History of Humanity.